Well, it's Friday, but the weekend can't actually start, of course, until we've picked through the wreckage of the last 7 days. Here's a reminder.
The boss of HSBC has said it's been a challenging year for the bank. Today, Chief Executive Stuart Gulliver even had to defend the way he put his own money in accounts in Panama and Switzerland.
HSBC have used the announcement of their end-of-year results to give another comprehensive and, it must be said, a long apology.
The US and EU are in talks to establish a transatlantic trade and investment partnership. The BBC has obtained a draft of what the EU wants excluded from the deal. That includes wording that UK ministers have said will protect the National Health Service from privatisation.
The United States will not do anything that restricts the right of regulators in the US or in the countries that we're partnering with to regulate in the public interest.
The Oscar for Best Actor went to the Briton Eddie Redmayne for his portrayal of the scientist Stephen Hawking.
It was pretty extraordinary. I don't think I've managed to make any sense of it just yet, but it was formidable.
So, HSBC's bottom line looking as unhealthy as their Swiss dealings. An insight into the transatlantic trade deal and what it may say about health services. And Tinseltown's annual pat on its own back, the Oscars. Well, sifting through all that with me have been Anne Bagomeri, who's the International Herald Tribune Europe editor, and Mark Gilbert of Bloomberg News here in London. First, Anne, unhappiness for HSBC now on all sides.
It's very interesting to see not just the write-downs that they've had to take for all of the malfeasance, but also the fact that even where they're trying to expand their business in wealth management particularly, they're not doing very well. You have to wonder if some of the grime that has attached to HSBC because of the problems with subprime mortgages and money laundering and the rest of it is beginning to stick in the public mind.
That's very interesting, Mark, isn't it? Because, I mean, we sort of think the banks are probably Teflon, basically. Whatever they do in the end, the bottom line is pretty good. It clearly isn't the case with HSBC.
I think all of the big investment banks are struggling to make money. One of the oddities of HSBC is it builds itself as the world's local bank, but it makes 80% of its profit in Asia. It really hasn't been doing well in the US. It hasn't done well in Europe. Listening to the comments from the CEO and the chairman this week, they're clearly afraid the government's going to force them to break up. They're trying to stress that being big is a good thing. They're trying to shrink some businesses. I wonder if it is time for them to be broken up. And certainly, if I was an investor looking at the share price, you've got to think it might be time for new management.
Well, that's interesting. And the point you were making, that the nastiness has rubbed off on them, that, I guess, may lie behind the political pressure to break them up.
We shouldn't go too fast in assuming that the politicians will actually punish a bank that is clearly too big to fail and not just in its own mind. HSBC and all of the big banks have skated with fines that look big on paper, billions of dollars, but really represent a couple of weeks' revenue for institutions like this. And they've played on the sympathy of the regulators and the politicians that if one of the big banks fails, then the financial system is at risk. I think that is much less the case now since the financial crisis was some of the strictures that have been enacted. I mean, HSBC may be concerned, but I think we should hesitate before we share that concern and start feeling sorry for them.
Mark, you don't feel sorry for them, do you?
It'd be very hard to find any sympathy for the number of scandals they've been involved in. You know, Stuart Gulliver, the CEO, said this week, look, there's 250,000 employees. How do you expect me to know what they're all up to? Well, the answer to that should be, well, you shouldn't have 250,000 employees then, I think, Stuart.
Yes, the absolute too-big-to-fail element in all that. Let's move on to the transatlantic trade deal. We did get an insight this week into what Europe wants out of it, and I suppose the headline certainly here in Britain was an element of concern about the National Health Service being brought in, competition being brought into an area, commercial competition, in a way it hasn't before. I mean, Anne, looking at that, where do you think the TTIP stands at the moment?
These trade deals always exhaust our patience and our attention span. Look at things like the Doha round, which I don't even think is over yet. Trade deals take forever to negotiate because, although ironically they're called free trade deals, everybody wants their little opt-out, and so they end up being quite a bit less free than they started out to be. It's inevitable that some kind of pact will be voted. Every country is probably going to stand behind the one thing that they deeply want to preserve. In the case of Britain, it's going to be the independence of the NHS. Britain is right to be sure that the I's are dotted and the T's are crossed on the National Health Service, because the privatization of health care, as we can see in my home country, the United States, has not gone well.
But Mark, in the end, I think what's changed in the last few years is this perception that they aren't necessarily good for everyone.
There's still a lot of areas of friction as well. You know, the business of the NHS is particular to the UK, but Europe as a whole wants financial services included in this deal, which the US certainly isn't very keen on having to pay attention to how the EU wants to regulate the banking industry. There's another issue about data. Australia, for instance, has a law that health records have to be stored in Australia. That could be seen as a restriction on trade, but given what's been happening in the US data market, where nothing seems safe or sacred, I think other countries would quite like to have the right to keep their data in their own country. So there's still a lot of stumbling blocks along the way, but you're right, these deals get done in the end, but they take a long time.
And talking about protectionism, and famously the French have been very protective about their film industry. We did see that the Hollywood end of the film industry is looking in pretty rude health, I think, at the Oscars, even if there were a few embarrassing moments. What do you read from the latest Oscars as a way of taking the temperature of the movie industry?
Oh, I don't think you can take the Oscars as taking the temperature of anything but a small group of people in power in Hollywood. But what was interesting is that even though there's lots of celebration of Tinseltown in the old-fashioned sense, if you look at the films that were nominated for Best Picture by this very conservative and very establishment group, a lot of them were, all but one, I believe, was an independent film or had an indie sensibility.
Mark, I mean, do you see it as it is essentially a commercial industry, clearly. But do you detect the indie films get the recognition, but it's things like American Sniper that didn't do that well that actually bring in the crowds?
And it's not just the indie films. The indie cinema movement, particularly in the UK, is doing very, very well. My local cinema, The Screen on the Green, small independent cinema, has sofas, brings wine to your table, brings snacks to you and lets you eat during the film. It's absolutely amazing. You know, it's exciting. Eddie Redmayne winning for The Theory of Everything. I almost took down my copy of Stephen Hawking's A Brief History of Time from the bookshelf and cracked the spine for the first time.
I had another go,
but I didn't.
I didn't, but I did manage to read it years ago, but I didn't understand much of it. Anyway, that was Mark Gilbert, Bloomberg News London Bureau Chief, and also I was talking to Anne Bagomeri, International New York Times Europe Editor, who was in Paris.